This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You may not know what a quindar is, but you have definitely heard one.
The Eagle has landed. Roger, Tranquility. We copy you on the ground. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot.
Remember those little beeps in the background? They are quindar tones. They're almost as iconic as Neil Armstrong's The Eagle Has Landed quote. Those tones are created by ground control to turn on and off the radio transmitters used to talk to astronauts. Quindar tones, named after the company that made the equipment, were so ubiquitous during the 60s space race to the moon and right into the shuttle program that my next guests took inspiration from them as they combed through NASA's audio archives, all in a quest to make an album, a soundtrack telling the story of spaceflight. Please welcome the member of the musical group Quindar, and their new album is called Hip Mobility. Michael Jorgensen, when he's not exploring the bleeps and pings of NASA, is keyboardist for the band Wilco. He's based out in Ojai, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. James Merle Thomas is a musician and art historian based out of Philadelphia. Welcome to you, too.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
James, you both have been trying to collaborate on a project together for a while. What was the light bulb in your head? Why did this NASA material make sense to you guys?
Well, to tell that story is to go back to about 2011, 2012. And at the time when I was finishing my doctorate, I was working as a fellow at the National Air and Space Museum. And at the time, I was looking at how artists and architects were collaborating with engineers at NASA to design for space. In other words, what it meant to build something like the interior of Skylab as a kind of house that would be different from a regular spacecraft. And when I was researching that material, I started encountering a lot of archival stuff, old industrial films, archival audio. And it's not the stuff of the heroic missions that we always think of. It wasn't the countdowns. It wasn't the triumphant sound clips, but it was really the mundane stuff of every day. It was tape hiss. It was microphones that were left on. It was people talking about what it meant to, what it felt like to live in space for a long time. And it felt almost like a deep portrait of what it meant to live at that given moment in a very unique place. And I thought that would make an excellent starting point for telling a story or making some compositions using those sounds.
And so why did you choose the quindar? What does that sound represent to you, Michael?
Well, Michael, do you want to jump in?
Sure. when James and I had our initial writing session in 2011, we would text each other in between these writing sessions, and I remember saying, hey, what are those sounds? What are those beeps called? Surely they've got a name. And then, and James like, oh, those are called quindar tones. And I was like, oh man, well that's the name of this. And then we further discovered what a quindar tone was, and it is, as you sort of described earlier, it is a handshake between telemetry systems that keep the mission control and spacecraft communications open. So it's sort of like are you there? And then the spacecraft's like, yeah, I'm here. Are you still there? And back and forth. And it sort of talks about some element of what it is that we do musically.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys consider yourselves geeks? I was thinking about
I do. I just own it. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Because I was looking, Michael, you're the keyboardist in Wilco, and was Wilco chosen because of its reference to Roger Wilco, two-way radio stuff?
It's part of the band history that I wasn't around at that point, the genesis of the band, but it is also part of it speaks to this disconnected transmission of musical ideas or of emotion through radio waves, and you would back before the internet, you would listen to music on a discrete box that had a battery, and you could take it with you and hear this music. And I think that the Roger Wilco is also sort of like an acknowledgement of a communication received.
Yeah, enough of talking about your music. Let's listen to some of it, because people want to hear how you've got the Quindar tones into your music and all these other background music. So I'm going to play a clip called Honeysuckle, and let's listen to Honeysuckle. This is Houston.
Setting the cannon all configured. 1, 2, 3, 4.
That's cool. I like that. James, what was your approach to putting that track out there?
Well, I think when we started listening to this audio, and indeed the first part of making a Quindar record is sitting around and listening to hours and hours of archival audio, one of the first things that leapt out to us right away is that you hear that difference in the two tones. They're actually at two different frequencies. And we were struck by the fact that, you know, this is basically a synthesizer that NASA is playing, right? This is a mm-hmm. this is a kind of complex note structure that's being beamed out into the ether. And so we immediately started thinking, well, what if we push and pull with this kind of fixed industrial standard and think about it less like a precise measure of communication and think about it more like an expressive instrument. And it was a really short path from that way of thinking to then thinking about, well, what was happening with synthesizers at this same moment, and you know, what were composers like Stockhausen or John Cage doing when they were using similar devices to create sounds? And in that very same track, if you listen a little deeper later on, you start hearing these really sort of rich, dense textural sounds that sound a lot like an organ. The, you mm-hmm. know, the Quindar tones are throughout the whole record. You hear them in a lot of different ways.
Let's actually play. I'm going to play a Quindar, the actual Quindar sound. If people want to, you'll recognize it immediately. And actually, if you listen, there are two tones to it. They're not quite exactly the same frequency, are they, Michael?
No, they're not a musical interval apart, but they are, I think, something maybe like 100 hertz or something different from each other.
Mm-hmm. And there are two tones, one just to sort of turn on the transmission, one to bring it back?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you heard that? I mean, that's sort of an iconic sound for anybody who listened to the Space Race over the 60s and into the 70s. I'm going to play another one of your cuts called the Chaco Hilton, and I want people to listen to Chaco Hilton, and we'll talk about it. Now, what was your inspiration for that?
Well, you can probably make out that there was some sort of astronaut-sounding chatter going on there, and I thought it would be interesting to take the actual, to maybe just work with the sound of the transmissions rather than the information that was part of the message. So it is really kind of like using the shell of the information, and I took those conversations, and I sliced it up in the computer and was able to access different parts of a phrase and then resequenced it with a rhythmic pattern. And that to me was like it was more of like a percussive element or like a shaker or a drum kind of element. And I thought it was kind of interesting to take what typically is the focal point of a song, where like in a traditional sense of like a person playing acoustic guitar or piano and then singing lyrics, you know, take that and sort of subvert it a little bit.
Yeah, because it does have that sound back, you know, in the 60s, that kind of rhythm to it. And I know, James, you studied NASA during the Cold War era. Why is that period interesting to you?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's another chapter in the American experience. I think, you know, I approached it, you know, I've been working on a lot of this material from the perspective of being an art historian and someone who's really interested in aesthetic questions and how different kinds of media intersect with technology. So, you know, a good parallel to all of this would be an artist like Robert Rauschenberg, who was actually invited by NASA in July of 69 to travel to the Cape and to witness the launch of Apollo 11. And Rauschenberg was, you know, he was an official guest of the agency, and like a number of other artists, he was asked to provide some kind of interpretation of the experience. Mm-hmm. Only Rauschenberg didn't set up an easel and paint like everyone else. He immediately started rooting around in the engineer's trash cans and found schematics and blueprints and tourist maps from Cocoa Beach. And he really upended the narrative that NASA was trying to create and made a sort of wild kaleidoscopic set of collages. They're called Stoned Moon. And I think that, you know, there's something in the spirit of rewriting a narrative, of maybe thinking differently about the way a countdown works or the way that we're told a story, and to reshuffle the order in which it's told. I think there's something in that way of thinking that really really informed the way that we were thinking about composition on this album.
Mm-hmm. This is all quite interesting stuff here. What's the meaning behind, we just played the Chaco Hilton. What was the meaning behind the little Chaco Hilton? What does that mean?
There's a great backstory there. I think, especially on a day like this, whenever, it's the anniversary of Armstrong,
right,
and crew coming back from the moon, we're thinking about the kind of pristine spaces that they occupied, right? The clean rooms, the pressurized chambers, the quarantine space on the deck of the Hornet and whatnot. Well, there's a whole other side to NASA to think about. I was really struck by the fact that in the run-up to all of these missions, the astronauts had to do a lot of training in the tropics and in extreme climates to plan for different kinds of possible outcomes. And Chaco Hilton is an affectionate name given to the shack that the astronauts were staying in whenever they were doing training in Central America and were encountering any number of indigenous persons at that time. And I think the idea of NASA and the tropics is a very different kind of image than the one that we normally associate with the agency.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Okay, so just joined us. We're talking with Michael Jorgensen and James Merle Thomas about Quindar. You have to say it correctly. Cause, you know.
So nice it beeps twice.
Well, Michael, as a musician, the technology that was coming out of NASA must have been pretty, speaking of that, but must have been pretty interesting to you.
Sure. As a lifelong fan of 3-2-1 contact and Newton's apple, my space and science fascination was early and profound. And in hindsight too, because we live in a time that is so sort of digital, and the NASA missions were sort of very sort of like unapologetically, and they didn't really have a choice, but analog. There was 16 millimeter film and magnetic tape going up into space, capturing sounds and images. The advancements, advances that were made due to the space agency funding, sort of directly inspired and made technologies available for commercial synthesizer apparatus. The Quindar module being a kind of prime example. My dad was a recording engineer in New York City, and he brought me to the studio where I kind of first saw my first control panel, where I was like, wow, this is amazing. And not only is this like seductive and blinking and view meters wiggling, there's people playing music on the other side of the glass, and having that sort of experience as the foundation of my kind of musical and technical career, in a way, sort of this intersection of NASA and electronic music, sort of to me was a logical extension of all of those interests.
Before our time runs out, I want to get to another track. There's a track about two spiders who were sent to space. let's listen and talk about why that story interested you. Michael, the sound of interest on that one was right at the beginning, sort of in the background, right? That's where you hear it.
Yeah, that's right. That moment actually was kind of a gym genesis. So I'll let him take the reins on this one here.
Well, the sound in question came from a microphone just being dragged across the table before a press conference. And it's sort of indicative of the way Quindar works. Sometimes we start with a sound, we build a whole song around it, and then we scale it out and pull it back in. And then the only thing that's left is a sort of fragment or trace of the original archival sound. So in that case, you know, the sort of prelude to the actual message was the sound that we kept. But you were alluding to the message, the sort of humble story or the sort of poignant story there. And I like to think of the song as a kind of elegy to the two spiders that so prominently figured into some of the Skylab experiments. There's something sweet about making a song for a grade school science experiment that a number of astronauts helped to realize then.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish you great luck with your album. They're really interesting. It's really interesting music. We have a little bit from Hip Mobility on our website at sciencefriday.com/Quindar. Thanks for evolving the music with us. And
thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Thanks for all you guys do, and it's quite interesting stuff. Thanks for coming
Thanks so
on.
Much. It's it. Wonderful to speak with you.
Michael Jorgensen is a keyboardist for the band Wilco. James Merle Thomas is a musician and an art historian, and they both make up the group Quindar. And as I say, there is a little bit of a clip from their album Hip Mobility on our website at sciencefriday.com/Quindar. Charles Berkowitz is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, Katie Haller. Neil Rausch engineered our show today. Also, thanks to Brian McCabe and all the folks over at NPR for their studio help this week. If you'd like to write us, send your letter to Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. You can email us. You know, our SciFry address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. And, of course, every day is Science Friday on the web. We're tweeting all day, every day, and Facebooking and everywhere else on social communities. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.